what the format is, and then I'll walk through what I've my review of the current biennium and the shortfall, and then make some suggestions that I think will help improve the forecast process.
All right. Tom Petoskey and Mike Kennedy, we welcome you back this morning. I say welcome back. I guess it's your first appearance before this 72nd Legislative Assembly Revenue Committee, so welcome you to that. Turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the House Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Petoskey, State Economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. Also with me today is Michael Kennedy, a Revenue Economist, also with the Office of Economic Analysis. We'll get right into this. What we're going to do today is give you a little overview of our revenue forecast process that we do in our office. Paul will follow up with an assessment from his review and some recommendations of changes, which we have concurred with Paul on those. The forecast objective for the office, we're really trying to produce what we call unbiased forecasts of general fund revenues. And what we mean by this is there should be an equal, in a sense, opportunity to find forecasts that are just likely to be above what we're forecasting as likely to be below where we're forecasting. In that, because of certain noise and so on that occurs in the data and what we're looking at, plus we're forecasting, basically, when we come to the May 15th forecast, it's over a two-year period of time. A lot can change that can't be necessarily captured by a forecast. But the objective is that we're trying to hit a baseline forecast that is the errors should be somewhat random around that forecast over time. Our revenue forecast methodology that we use, first we have some components to this forecast, the main one, main two being corporate income tax collections. Net, of course, of refund.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Before we get off of the general objective, do you work on or establish some kind of a confidence level that you try to use in dealing with that equal likelihood? I mean, do you have a range that you think it's likely to fall into based on some confidence level, or how do you go about determining what that likely range is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes, we do. In the past, what we have presented in our forecast has only been the baseline forecast and then a discussion of risks around that forecast, events that may happen that could push that forecast, the actuals, one way or the other way from that forecast. But the other approach that we're doing now is to take a look what has been the sort of range of errors around the forecast? And that gives you some sense of the risk of what could occur. And so I think Michael will address this later, but essentially it's, you know, there's a certain percentage that we believe that either below or above is under the realms of possibility of happening. But we believe the further you get away from that baseline forecast, the less the chances of those occurring. But Michael will address what our range that actually we're looking at these days.
Great. Thank you.
We also forecast some of the other areas that are a little bit smaller, especially smaller than the personal, cigarette, tobacco, gift, inheritance taxes, interest earnings that also make up the general fund. Then also, we also receive forecasts from various agencies on some of the other funds that are presented here. Just a quick overview of our economic and revenue models. We have a Governor's Council of Economic Advisors made up of a dozen people from various sectors of the economy, people from the utility business, from high tech, forestry, retail, utilities, that help us gauge what's happening in the economy. Our models sometimes cannot quite capture what exactly happens at the moment, and these people have a good pulse of the Oregon economy and can help us in that capacity. So we meet with them and we discuss the U.S. Economic and history forecast. And the U.S. economy have a number of variables which influence our economic model. And that we put together, and then through the discussion with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, we start to put out a preliminary model forecast for the economy. Then we meet once again, and this, by the way, is a quarterly forecast that we put out. We meet again with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors and also a DAS Advisory Committee. This is made up of various government agencies who are essentially the clients of our forecast, people like the Employment Department, ODOT, Oregon Department of Forestry, Agriculture, Revenue, Treasury, come and we discuss what we view to be our outlook for the Oregon economic.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Are those agencies that participate on the advisory committee, is there a list available, Tom? Is that in your material?
Yes. In fact, I believe the list is now available on our website.
Okay.
But I can also get that to you.
Does it include DHS?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
After that discussion, we come up with our final economic forecast, and the variables in that forecast then are main drivers in both our personal income tax models and also our corporate income tax models. Michael will expand out those two models in his presentation. From there, we look at the legislative and policy changes that come from LRO. Those are provided to us, and we incorporate those then into the forecast. And then finally, we get our final revenue estimates. It's sort of the process we go through each quarter. And the process takes a little over 10 weeks.
General Williams has a question.
That was what I was going to ask, actually, Tom, is when do you get a forecast out on the day that it's released? How soon before you start working? It sounds like you start almost immediately on the next round.
Almost. I do the chicken and pea circuit usually right after a forecast is released, and business groups want to know what happened, and I give talks around. And then, for example, in this process for the March forecast, which will be released, I believe, February 28th to you, we started our first meetings with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors on January 17th. And this week from this Friday, February 7th, we will have this meeting where we have the Governor's Council again and the DAS Advisory Committee will meet.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and with that, I turn that over to Michael Kennedy, talking more specifically about the specific revenue forecast models.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Kennedy with the Office of Economic Analysis. I'm going to give an overview of the models behind the corporate and personal income tax forecast. These are still fairly high level, and there are then documentation on the details underlying this that are available if you wish. But in very general sense, this is the system that we're trying to model with respect to the personal income tax forecast. You have general economic conditions which then impact income earned by Oregonians, and that income then begets a tax liability in any given year, and then at some point in time that tax liability is paid to the state in terms of collections. So there's a general link here between the eventual money we get in the state and the economic conditions that are out there at any given point in time. Now, in a little more detail, this is basically the process that goes on each quarter. As you can tell, there are a number of components ranging from a model of the distribution of Oregonians with respect to income and filer type. That's one of the first pieces, ranging down to then the end product, which is a quarterly forecast of tax collections that we get. And as you can see, feeding into this at various places is information from a variety of sources, including the Department of Revenue, Legislative Revenue Office, our national forecasting consultant, Global Insights, federal government, some of our own professional experience, and historical data.
Mike, Global Insights, just tell us a little bit about this. Is your the national consultant?
Yes, we subscribe to a firm that provides extensive information and a ton of variables that feed into the Oregon economic model. They also provide us with a good sense of what's happening in the national economy, what their outlook is, for example, the war with Iraq, you know, what are possible impacts that might be on the economy and how that may then roll into the Oregon model. They originally are made up of two forecasting groups, which was called DRI, Data Resources, and WEFA, the Wharton Econometric Financial Group. They joined forces together and decided to change their name now to Global Insights.
Okay, because I knew DRI WEFA. They consult with, I assume, several states around the country. What are I'm just curious, how big is their reach?
Their reach is worldwide, both in terms of companies. For example, when they come into town, they usually coordinate with PGE, Pacific Power, our customers. So they also consult with them at the same time while they're in town here.
So if they're right, we're all right. And if they're wrong, we're all wrong.
How have they been doing so far, Tom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams. In various areas, they do okay. And then some areas, things like corporate profits, forecasts, which is a notoriously tough thing to do, they're probably doing just as well as anybody else. Anyone else's lousy forecast.
Okay. In fact, most of those U.S. variables feed into the revenue models through the Oregon economic model, from where we get personal income and employment data. So in terms of the process, as I mentioned before, we have a model that forecasts the number of Oregonian filers, tax filers, in any given year by type, joint and or single filer, and by level of income. And we have 24 brackets ranging from negative gross income to over $1 million in gross income, and brackets in between. And that model incorporates employment, income, and a variety of economic indicators that beget other forms of income, such as equity values, interest rates. And that's used then to project number of filers in each of these brackets. Currently, we're projecting out to 2009. That's our current forecast horizon. We then provide those forecasts to the Legislative Revenue Office, and those are fed into a model known as the tax calculator, and that calculates basically the liability that's going to be associated with any given filer, representative filer, in those brackets. And that's using a sample of tax returns from Department of Revenue to make those estimates. So then you sum that all up, you have a liability estimate for a given year, which supposedly then is the tax owed to us and that we will eventually receive. Another thing this calculator is useful in doing is looking at impact analyses, because it's able to look at various filers and look at what would happen with, say, a change in the marginal tax rates, such as would have happened with Measure 28. So a variety of information coming out of there. Now, one of the issues there is that given the fact that 10% of filers in Oregon pay about 80% of the income tax, it ends up that the number of filers that are forecast at these higher bracket ranges, the high fourth, third, second, and first, basically our liability estimate is very sensitive to that. And so we can be off either way depending upon how accurate that forecast is. So one of the things we do is a companion forecast that more generally looks at the historical relationship between income and liability. And that's basically used as a check. You look at both. If they're consistent, well, you feel fairly confident. If they start to diverge, then you go looking for what might be the issues underlying the divergence. Is it a problem with the filer distribution forecast? Is it a problem with our effective tax rate forecast, et cetera? But it gives us an idea that we need to do some more analysis. And we compare those, and we eventually have to decide, using some of our own judgment, about what our liability forecast is going to be. And that drives the collections forecast. the remaining task then is to figure out when we're going to get the money that is forecasted to be owed Oregon. And we do that by first we translate liability into the form of collection we're going to get. And personal income tax comes in the form of withholding on wages, estimated payments on non-wage income. And then at tax time, there's a reconciliation in which Oregonians decide whether they owe additional and or owed a refund. And that sum total equals liability. We then shift those payments out to the point where we expect to receive them based upon historical patterns. And the following graph then shows each of those both distribution along the bottom in terms of the type of payment. So 86% of liability we actually receive during the year as withholding on wages. We receive an additional 18% on other non-wage income, and that actually amounts to more than Oregonians are going to owe in the end. And so refunds then come tax time, come April. There will actually be more refunds than final payments, and so we'll have a net outflow in April and May. And then you can see also the timing of those payments and or refunds. And so that's used then to create our collections forecast, to which we then look and say, okay, is there anything suspect here? Do we need to do some add factors? Is there something the model's not picking up that we know about? We make adjustments there. Plus, we include all of the impact analyses from Legislative Revenue Office on tax law changes that are not currently in the data, thus are not making it into our model. And the end result of that is what you see here, which is a quarterly collections forecast by type of payment. And as you can see there, there's definite seasonality there, plus some variability. Now, corporate income tax is essentially the same. It's not quite as complex, but it follows along the same lines in that we forecast liability that corporations are going to owe, and then we translate that liability into collections. So we produce a liability forecast, and that generally uses that national or U.S. corporate profits figure from Global Insights, and then apportions that to Oregon based upon our share of U.S. personal income. So that's the variable that drives most of the liability estimates here. And then as with the personal income tax, that is translated into the type of payment, advance payments made during the tax year, plus final and refunds to reconcile after the tax year. And then they're shifted forward to the point where we expect to receive them.
Can I ask a question again,
Mr. Chair? Can you go back one slide for me? On the top there where you talk about the liability model they're forecasted using the national corporate profits and Oregon share of U.S. personal income, does the Oregon share of U.S. personal income, if you judge that over time to be an appropriate factor for identifying regional differences, I could see where, for example, our share of personal income, given you know what maybe happened in the late 90s and into 2000, would be different perhaps than if you took the current recession and overlaid it on top of perhaps the regional differences, where it might not be as good a factor in estimating. I'm just interested in why that's the function that you use to sort of take our cut to analyze that liability issue. Maybe you can explain it to me better.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, between the two of us, I think Tom may have more of a historical perspective. In terms of the corporate income model, first of all, the volatility there is pretty extreme. I mean, you have highs ranging 100% up, 100% down. And so there's a lot of volatility there to begin with. This is basically, I think, the best you can do given the nature of corporate income, potentially global earnings being apportioned back to Oregon. That's pretty much the variable I think that performs best, quote-unquote best, as it can get. I'm not sure about the historical development of that. Tom may have more insight, and or Paul.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, the best that we have is this national forecast of corporate profits. And so what we'd like to be able to do is, you know, to what extent is that reflective of possibly corporate profits in Oregon? And so in trying to find some relative size comparison ratio, historically what's been used in the office is to try to see, well, we do have information on Oregon personal income and personal income at the U.S. level. And possibly this sort of share of activity might be reflective of what's happening in corporate profits.
It just seems to the extent that we're so regionalized sometimes in various areas. Our heavy, in the early 80s, reliance, for example, on the timber economy and the impacts that that recession and environmental laws and things like that that suppress that industry would not necessarily track with our share of the U.S. personal income as it relates to corporate profits. In other words, I guess I'm struggling a little bit to know whether or not that's and it may be the only measure that you've got any reliability on without having to really regionalize the forecast, but I just was interested in using that comparative. Paul, do you have any?
There's two things we're trying to capture there. One is some relative profitability of companies with a substantial Oregon presence. And income can help you a little bit in doing that. And income, you know, if our companies are not as profitable, then we expect our income to fall compared to the U.S. And we do see that kind of pattern. In the mid-90s, that ratio of corporate liability to national profits just skyrocketed in Oregon, almost doubled. And that was when we had that huge jump in corporate revenue coming in. But a lot of that was attributed to just a couple of companies mm-hmm. that were extremely profitable at the time. The other thing that you're trying to capture there is the apportionment factor. And as we increase the weight on the sales factor, I think the income measure may become a better explanatory variable because, you know, you're focusing on sales, and sales will probably be more closely related to income.
Sure.
So that might help a little bit in that area. But still, it's if you look at the corporate data that Elizabeth went through it with us, you know, it's a relatively small number of companies. And many times their profitability can be dependent on a whole host of factors. So
it
doesn't
necessarily track with U.S. or even personal income.
That's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it could be timing issues too, I suppose. Just
yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One of the issues with the corporate tax model is that corporations do not have a consistent tax year. So it makes it far more interesting. You can see here that payments can be made and refunds sent out on a given tax year over the span of three or more years, farther as far as delinquent payments are concerned. So it's a little more interesting if there's less of the regular seasonality and predictability of the arrival of the receipts to the state of Oregon. But in general, the same process is used. This timing pattern and distribution is used to translate that liability out to when we expect to receive the payments, and as with the personal income model, we again look to see if there's anything suspect, plus also incorporate all of the impacts, including the bonus depreciation impact that was prepared for us, that was prepared by the Legislative Revenue Office. And that is basically tacked on top of what our forecast is. And you can just see the variability here. There's some significant ups and downs in the corporate income tax receipts. And then the last issue is then legislative session, the May 15th revenue forecast is then taken, added to that, or any of the legislative actions you take, and that equals the close of session forecast, which is presented with the September forecast publication, and that, of course, is the baseline for any kicker calculations with respect to eventual actual revenues.
Representative Bertram.
Are there any industries that you particularly look at, or even on the national scale, that are some very close measures to what's happening in the economy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, We definitely look at the high-tech industry, especially semiconductors, especially their influence that they have on the corporate profits income. Those are worldwide firms. What is happening out both nationally in the U.S. and worldwide is going to affect their sales and their capability of competing in the world. So those really in particular we look at. Also the lumber and wood industry. National factors affect that, and international factors. Looking at the Canadian soft lumber and the tariffs that have been placed on those, and what impact does that have here? Other imports, their ability that they can export out. Those type transportation equipment's another area. What's happening nationally in the trucking industry, for example, affects Freightliner. What's happening with interest rates and gasoline prices tend to affect the RV makers too. So some of those, you know, those are some of the main ones that we look that have an exposure both nationally and internationally that we compare to what's happening out in the world there.
Yes, sure.
But you don't look at any particular industry that might be a prerequisite in their data to an economic drop. In other words, there's not a thermometer there in certain industries that would be predictable that over the horizon there's very likely going to be a drop in the economy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, there's a few indicators out there. One very broad one is the Institute of Supply Management. They have an indicator that has not too bad of a track record of saying when this indicator falls at a certain level, a couple months into the future, we should expect overall manufacturing to have some problems.
Kind of like the barometer before the storm.
Yes, exactly. In the high-tech sector, there is something called the semiconductor book-to-bill ratio, looking at, well, what are orders that are coming in, what's being shipped out. And so if shipping out is seems to be stronger than bookings coming in, well, that might be a slowdown for that industry. Opposite, if bookings are really strong and they're not shipping out, well, there may be an indication that shipments are going to be building up then, and they're going to be expanding maybe. So there are a few indicators like that. Well, actually, we're going to, and Paul will relate to this too, we have noticed that the turning point's extremely difficult to predict. So we're in the process right now of building a leading economic indicator model for Oregon so that we maybe have another tool to see when these, you know, a barometer of when things are changing a little sooner than what we've seen in the past.
I have a question as we get into the historical performance, and maybe you'll get to this, but has the model changed significantly over the last 5 years, 10 years, the period of time that we're going to be measuring performance? Have there been substantial changes in the modeling or information that's being plugged into the modeling, or has it been fairly consistent over the years?
Mr. Chair, I've been around for a year, so I don't...
Okay, over the month.
But in fact, the structure of the model has pretty much been the same, I think, since it was developed. In terms of the liability model, however, what is driving incomes has changed, and that has then changed in our modeling. Capital gains is an obvious example, and there are other types of income, retirement income, in general, has been going up and becoming more and more of a factor. And so we changed basically the structure of that model to reflect what are the important drivers. In terms of the process, though, that was outlined, it's pretty much the same pieces and only the sort of the...
Paul, your history goes back a little more than a year. Can you think of any major changes in the forecasting methodology?
Mr. Chair, I think that the structure there is pretty much, the process itself is pretty much as it was laid out by Chang Mok-san in 1981 as the first state economist. But I think that the key difference has been that change in the in the, as Michael said, in the components of adjusted gross income and the components of the tax base. The other big change, of course, has been the emergence of high tech and the semiconductor industry over the last 10 years. But the model's been able to capture that. And also been able to capture the decline in lumber and wood products.
But that's, that's not so much a change in the methodology. That's just
the framework was able to capture that pretty well. What it has had a tougher time with is the adjusted gross income and the components of the tax base.
Mm-hmm.
As Mike pointed out, the key to this is trying to get that upper income group, because they're the ones who are paying the taxes. That's a huge proportion of the burden, and that's where I think you've seen the biggest difficulties, because you have changes in distribution income, and that's where you see the changes in the components of income. And I think we're still grappling with trying to capture that.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just to follow up, my question was your question, except instead of 5 years, the last 5 months, because I remember, I think it was the September forecast where the roof really fell in. Maybe I think it was an additional $500 million shortfall. We had a meeting comment. I think you said, well, we kind of undershot the stock options and the bonuses and the capital gains from some mostly high-tech sector. And I'm just wondering if those factors that you saw in the fall are being worked into new models, or is that too soon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, and maybe Michael can also comment on this. What we've done is we've incorporated those in, and we recognize those even before that September forecast. Our difficulty, and we've been working with the Department of Revenue on this, is they have to collect all the data, and when we know what's actually happened out there, tends to be pretty late down the road. They've been doing sampling for us to get a closer picture, an earlier picture, than possibly almost like a year and a half later from the tax year when it occurred. So that has been helpful, and that's in a sense a change of process that we think with their cooperation that they've been giving us and being able to provide information sooner to get a peek at what's going on is going to be helpful.
Okay. Take us
forward. And I think the next few slides are going to take us further along this discussion.
Historical.
Now, just in terms of actual general fund revenue growth, here you can see both what historically the average has been and the variability around that average, particularly in the last few years, as we know. And one of the things we did in order to try to assess this idea of performance is look at how actual revenues have come in the last 20 years relative to both the close of session forecast, how has that performed, but also we wanted a baseline for that, and we said assume you just took the historical growth rate in general fund and you took each actual biennium, and then you said what would be your forecast based on that for the subsequent biennium. And so what you have here is how either of those methods would have compared to actuals, actually how actuals would have compared to either of those. So for instance, in 81-83, you see there that is actuals came in roughly 2 or 3% below what would have been your naive guess, and they came in more like 7% below what the close of session is. So in that case, what you say here is the close of session forecast was more optimistic than what would have been based on just a naive, blind, backward-looking guess. And that's played out here. As you can see, for the most part in the 90s, the close of session forecast has outperformed a naive guess, which you should expect. We supposedly have better information than just some single growth number, but not in all cases. And the question there is then, why not? What can possibly explain not having better information than a blind guess? And this is really going to speak to that September drop, the December change. What I wanted to do here is look at, for example, what data were available for the December forecast. Supposedly this information is more enlightening than just, say, straight ruling out a 13% growth. Well, we had tax collections through October 2002. That's our most recent information. And the only issue there is, in fact, the volatility of quarterly collections. There's actually a lot of underlying factors in changes in these. And this is year over year, so there's no seasonality here. This is just how variable collections can be in one quarter relative to the same quarter a year prior.
Michael, could you go back two slides for a second? I want to make sure. Sure. A very interesting slide, that forecast versus naive trend. Is that like measuring the difference between a managed fund versus I was thinking an investment. You've got a managed fund versus an index fund or something like that. Is that what we're really talking about here? In one case, you just put your money in an index fund that's really not tied to anything. It just goes with the index. Mm-hmm. Whereas you put your money into a managed fund and you got folks trying to time and invest and target and those kinds of things. Is that comparable to what we're talking about here?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a very, very good analogy.
And so, Paul?
Well, the only thing I would add is that, you know, I think you have to recognize that 13.5% is over the 81 to 2001, 2003 period. And again, thinking back to Chang Bok-sun, who became nicknamed Dr. Doom with his forecasts in the early 80s, he was looking at the 70s, and we had general fund revenue growth approaching 40%. Of course, a lot of it was inflation, but you know it was very rapid growth. So it may look like he was optimistic there, but when you look back on his history that he was looking at, I think it's quite a bit different. So it's kind of a moving target as it moves forward as you look back over the last, say, 20 years. So that's always changing.
And I suppose one of those things that an average over 20 years means one thing, but where it changes, the deviation is so great from biennium to biennium. Yes. That's where the risk is. Mm-hmm.
That's where the risk is, yes.
Okay, well, it's very interesting. I've never seen that graph before. Mm-hmm. Thanks. Go ahead.
Actually, while we're here, to go back to the issue of variability, and we actually looked at this period, this 20-year period plus, and what was the variance around that general trend, and what we came up with is, in fact, like a standard deviation of about 7.5%. Statistically speaking, that means roughly 70% of the time you're going to be between 7.5% above and or below the line. So, I mean, that's sort of in line with the old rule of thumb or the historical rule of thumb, the 6% cushion that I've heard about. Obviously, that can be different depending on what period you want to take, and if it includes the 0103 period as being the outlier, that's driving some of the reason why that 7.5 is a little higher than what you've been accustomed to.
Right. Okay.
So the issue here was our most recent data may not necessarily be our most informative data, in that collections can relate to up to three different tax years potentially, and also reflect filer behavior. If I can use a current issue right now, the fourth quarter of estimated payments for personal income tax filers was due on the 15th of January. And when we looked at the fourth quarter, and December in particular, estimated payments actually came in above forecast, and that looked very good. Since then, they've come in below forecast for this quarter, and what it looks is happening that is that some personal income tax filers paid prior to the 31st to get that deduction against their federal return.
I always do.
And in some years you get more of that, in other years you get less of that, and that can contribute here to this volatility. So a recent quarter, that most recent quarter we have going into another forecast, can be informative or it can be misleading, so it's not necessarily as nice as, say, having the latest data might sound. So what else did we have going into that forecast? We have national figures, personal income and employment, plus an Oregon figures related to those. And you might think, well, we'd have fairly recent data. What I'm actually showing here is the data that we are guaranteed probably is never going to change again, because they are revised up to 2 years after the fact. The personal and corporate tax return information, if I could step back a second, we get that from Department of Revenue. That's where they take all the tax returns following a tax filing season, process them. They don't get a lot of those until October because of extensions. Then it takes them a little while to cleanse them. So in terms of the December forecast, the latest year we had was 2000, where we could really look at the components of income, how those had changed, and how those have been driven changes in liability. So even as of this date, we don't have 2001 to really look at the absolute composition of 2001 and why that was so drastically below 2000. We have a lot of sample data and a lot of statistics, and we roughly know what happened. But in terms of an absolute look, that's coming up in the next couple weeks. Personal income data, the latest absolute final data was for 2000. To give you an example here, September, between the September forecast and the December forecast, the Oregon personal income number dropped $1 billion. That was the revision just in 3 months' time. And it corroborated what we'd basically seen in collections, but it wasn't until that time that you actually got validation on what you'd already seen.
I guess looking at this and this whole slide, it was just a function of how you do this, and it's not a criticism, but when you're watching the television and they show you the weather map, they look at the systems out to the west and they'll show you the systems that are moving in, and that's what the forecast is based on. The economic forecast seems to be about looking at the systems that have already passed across and are now over the Midwest and using those to tell you what the weather is going to be in the next week. And I think that may be what part of our problem is. Our forecast is always based on not always been, but there's so much in the forecast that is driven by what has already happened and moved on.
Mr. Chair, the analogy I carry in my head is of driving a stretch limo from a seat in the trunk, and unfortunately the seat is actually looking backwards. So as long as the road in front of you looks like the road behind you, you're
sure.
Great, but it's the turns that tend to throw you for a loop.
And looking at that bottom one, where the turning point's toughest for the econometric models to predict. Trouble is, those are exactly the points that for planning purposes, we need to know the most about, because if everything was staying on a static trend, we wouldn't need an Office of Economic Analysis. That is the problem, isn't it? That those are the very points that we need the information about in order to project ahead 2 years and 4 years, and that's the information that is the most unreliable.
Mr. Chair, I'm reminded of the economist from Ford Motor Company who made the quip that the future is really difficult to forecast when the past keeps changing.
this is good. Go ahead, Michael.
Mr. Chair, another point on the point you're making, of course, is that anybody who could actually do that prediction you're referring to would not be working for us doing economic models. They'd be out making a great deal of money doing something else. I mean, it's almost impossible to do that,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that person is in the Caribbean. And they are very wealthy. They knew what was going to happen in 99.
Well, that's right. And they also knew when to stop guessing. We expect you to do a forecast for us every quarter, no matter what.
Right.
But I would add, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that it is our information and the forecast and so on is better than a random guess.
Oh.
We hope. Well, let me just jump in on this part. We've really gone through some unusual times. For the economy. The 1990s expansion we went through was the longest we've had on record since we've kept these records, since the end of the Civil War. The stock market never before gained over 20% for three consecutive years. The Y2K situation, that's going to be a one and only time, I think in 1,000 years from now, we're not going to have that happen again to us. But it did cause, most likely, the last item, which was a reassessment of business investments, technology needs, and we had a bunching up of investments occur so that we ended up with the highest percentage of business fixed investments to GDP in history before we got into this recession. So we see this as an unusual time. And so when we're looking out forward, we're not expecting this to be the norm. You know, we get out of the recession, you come back, and stock market's 20% higher for 3 years, and business is taking off. And, we're not going to have huge number of firms all of a sudden of the Intel size come plop into the state. This is an unusual set of the stars lining up just right for us as we went through the 90s. Another aspect on this theme, this is just kind of comparison of what we were looking at as we were coming into the May forecast, which is the main economic forecast that sets the close of session forecast for this budget period we're in right now, and looking at employment growth as to what was the employment growth reported at that time, and then finally, what were the revised employment. And you can see we saw here the estimates that were available to us as we were making the May 1 forecast is the darkish blue. And things had slowed down, but still were in the positive growth area as we were making that forecast. Subsequently, the revisions to these employment growth show that, no, that actually that first quarter was actually a negative, about 1.1%, rather than a positive 0.8% growth. Now, one of the things we can do is say, oh, well, woe is us. You know, it's just, we have to live with it. Well, we want to be a little more proactive on this, and this is one of the areas where we think building this leading economic indicator model can help supplement some of this other information so that if we start to get some conflicting information where we see maybe employment says it's growing, but the indicator says, no, things are slowing down, that will be a cautionary note to us to take special care in what possibly may be happening in the economy.
So we wanted to wrap up with a recap of the December general fund revenue forecast, remind us of all where we are and what we were projecting at that time. For the current biennium, $9.2 billion, a number you're probably extremely familiar with. For the next biennium, we are projecting $10.9 billion. And you can see then a growth trend falling out from that. Just to put that in growth terms, obviously this biennium was 7% below and would have been even worse except for revenue actions. So the true structural drop was a little bit farther than that. It also is exaggerated if you actually include the kicker effects in federal pension, but those are not in here. So this is a fairly good picture of the structural change in our general fund revenues. So for next biennium, we are projecting a 13.6% growth over this biennium. And that number has caused a little bit of consternation. One of the issues we want to look at here, however, is that this biennium is not normal. It's actually considerably suppressed. And so 13.6% from that is not the same as taking a normal year and saying we're going to get 13.6% growth. It's actually only amounts to about 7% above what you would expect to see in normal economic times. So it's not as aggressive as it looks. And then beyond that, we're looking at slightly higher growth than average and then slightly lower. But all those percentages are based on ramping up from a low number. So they're actually, as we'll see in a few graphs here, fairly conservative, actually. But what is driving our forecast from here on out? And number one, we are forecasting an economic recovery. And, in fact, there is going to be some amount of a rebound. We are suppressed now, and we've been suppressed for a considerable amount of time. In particular, business inventories of computer equipment, among others, are aging. All of that investment that was done between, say, 96 and 2000, those are getting up there in years, between 4 and 7 years old, and that's about the time when you expect those to be replaced. And so at some point here, we're going to get, or we expect to get, what's going to be called a little boomlet, a little mirror or echo of that ramp up in the late 90s.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm interested in on this 13.6
issue, and I know you probably talked to a number of people about it who've had some questions about it, but it seems to me that, and I understand what you're saying, that when you're starting in a negative position and you're climbing back out of a negative position in an unusual set of circumstances, 13.6 is really not, I mean, when you're starting really low, it's not that big of a jump. But even a 7% growth rate, given sort of the current situation with the looming possibility of the energy price spike if war occurs with Iraq and some of those other things, it still seems, and maybe we're just so hunkered down in our misery here that we can't believe that anything good is going to happen, but that seems, it still seems aggressive to me. Even 7% growth seems aggressive to me in sort of our current state. And I guess I'm just interested in a response so you can assuage my fears that I'm all wrong.
Well, and when will the March forecast be coming out? End of this, about a month from now, right? Mm-hmm. And we'll have a chance to see whether that 13.6 holds up, I guess, mm-hmm. what the current information is at that point. But, yeah, are you going to assuage his concern?
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, I think in the next few graphs, I get it at exactly what the drivers are and the justification there.
Then I shall be quiet and listen.
Assuage away.
Another factor here is our personal income forecast from the economic model. And let's just look at what that is. So here you see our recovery scenario. And on average, personal income growth has been about 6.1% per year over the last, at least the last 10 years. 11
Mike,
years.
Michael, let me just, I'm sorry to interrupt, on the boomlet, going back, see where we all take about a minute and a half to kind of catch up with some of these things, but the, you know, does it, for instance, getting back to the leading edge indicators, does the boomlet forecast take into account, I mean, does that assume that I guess it's taking into account that we don't have the same base of manufacturers here in Oregon, the high tech that we had in the 90s, so that if there is an increase in production, that production may take place elsewhere and we may not benefit as substantially from it relatively to where we were in the 90s. Well, you got a lot of empty manufacturing space up in Washington County, and I'm not sure, just a gut sense tells me, I'm not sure that necessarily is going to come right back just because of an increase in orders when you've got production going overseas, you know, since the 90s to now. That may be where the boomlet's going to be felt in China and Vietnam and Korea and wherever else they're manufacturing these days, and it may not come back to Washington County. Do you get what I'm saying, what I'm getting at there?
Mr. Chair, perfectly. And in fact, that scenario, if there's any, you know, overly optimistic side to it, it's purely here. That's one of the things where I'm a little bit ahead of other people in terms of what I'm expecting in the next few years. In terms of our economic model, it doesn't really have as much of that in as I think may eventually come around, and for that very reason, in that we may not experience that here in Oregon to the degree that we did in the late 90s. Yeah. So when I put that out there, I'm saying I think the economy is going to come back a little stronger than just, you know, a flat historical perspective, but the degree that that's going to affect Oregon may not be as much as just in general.
And you're saying your forecast still reflects the more conservative, less optimistic.
Now, Mr. Chair, in the economic forecast, even the one used for the December forecast, we have coming out of recession, but nowhere near the buildup that we saw in the mid-1990s. So it's we're, in fact, I think high-tech employment doesn't get back to pre-recession level until probably maybe even late 2004.
Okay.
So to reconcile, however, personal income, you see returning, and so even... And one of the issues here I want to point out is that we're still 5 months from the beginning of that biennium. That's one of the issues, is we're still fairly a ways out in terms of economic swings. That there's still 29 months until the end of that biennium. And that's a lot of time considering how much change can happen in economic conditions between now and then. I mean, we could have the war come and go and be, well, recent distant memory by the time this biennium even starts. So... I mean, that's one of the issues, and it kind of gets to what Representative Williams was saying. We're here now, and the conditions are very real, and it's hard to project out, but in fact, things do change on fairly short order in the economy. But this still, you say, okay, fine. Even you see 2004 is 5.9, 2005 is 6.4, and those are going to feed into personal income tax receipts out there. That still doesn't get you to 13.5%. And in fact, this gets at one of the issues we were talking about in terms of personal income mapping to taxable income, and that disconnect there being one of the things that we are tackling currently to incorporate into our models better, particularly as that composition has, I mean, it's actually diverged, and that's something that now is more of an issue we need to tackle than it has been in the last 20 years as capital gains, retirement income, those things become more of a factor and taxable income diverges from personal income. And in particular, you can see historically, this just shows gross income in terms of the change, and this is gross income reported by Oregon filers, and you can see that capital gains and even retirement income have outpaced that growth in the last 20 years. So they've become a greater share, and in particular, retirement income, with baby boomers now reaching the leading edge, reaching about age 60, that group, as they retire, is going to impact this even more. And retirement income, for the most part, is not included in that personal income measure. So there's reason to believe that taxable income will grow somewhat stronger than even our personal income measure. The final issue here is that, as you can see here, since 1980, with the exception of that period where we actually increased the marginal rates as a result of the recession in 81, there's a steady increase in the effective tax rate on income due to bracket creep, as Oregonians creep up the income bracket. And so that even means that liability growth is a little bit stronger than the corresponding growth in taxable income. So all of those factors together, I think, get you to a number at least equal to 13.6% or consistent with that. Just to put this kind of all in perspective, this is a graph I like. Let's step back to before the late 90s. Okay, there was a temporary run-up, and we experienced a boom in personal income tax growth. Okay, so let's step before that and say, what did things look like? And prior to even the beginnings where corporate income was taking off in about 92, 93, 94, growth, depending on your beginning and end points, basically ranged between 7 and 8% per year in personal income tax growth. So take 7%, the low bound of that, and project that off pre-boom levels of personal income tax growth, and project those out. So this is, I mean, what I would consider the long-run revenue-generating capability of the economy, and a very conservative one. It doesn't even assume even average growth rates, but fairly conservative ones. So had there not been the boom, that is what I consider the long-run capacity there, and our forecast does not even come up to that again until 2006. And so this really says that, yeah, in terms of those percentage changes, they look pretty wild, but in terms of a more broad context, there is reason to believe that the forecast is actually fairly reasonable and not as aggressive as it looks.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Michael, you start at 78, so we're sort of watching a 20-year trend.
I'd be interested
in, you know, not that I have a distinct recollection of it because I was in junior high for most of that period of time, but in the early 70s we went through that period of sort of stagflation, is I think the phrase that was used, and I'd be interested, I mean, I guess I wonder whether a 20-year look-back model is the right one, or if what we're entering into as we walk into this new century is something more akin to the sort of economic flatline malaise we seem to experience in the 70s through the 80s, with the United States involved in sort of potentially unpopular conflicts around the world, and sort of a new economic experience that I think was affecting the country, not necessarily using the same economic indicators or experiences, but a similar kind of situation where things just sort of flatlined, it seemed, for quite some period of time, and then only at about in the late 70s and 80s sort of seemed to change and pull out of that. Am I wrong about my analysis on that, generally? I mean, I just wonder if 20 years is just looking at 20 years of sort of a period where things have gone relatively up, and we're not catching a period of time when we had another sort of lengthy period of time when things seemed to sort of flatline for a while.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, I was in junior high right at the beginning of this.
Well, he was in junior high for most of this, apparently.
That too, Brute.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, I was in the fifth grade.
Oh, good. There we go.
I was teaching.
You want to keep in mind, too, through this period of time, it includes your 80-82 period, which was a very rough period and probably the biggest recession in our country relative to the Great Depression.
Right.
So we've included that in this.
Paul, I'm sorry, Tom, you say that, but it doesn't look so bad compared to 2000, 2004, 2003.
Yes, but also in here you also have the increase in the tax rates that were passed that helped push that up. Otherwise, you would have something looking very similar to what we have in the 2002-2003 area. And then I think maybe Paul can say something. In the 70s, even though that was kind of a flat, I mean, it wasn't a great time to be in the stock market necessarily, but it was a time of fairly strong inflation, and the nominal incomes were going up quite rapidly, and being taxed on those nominal incomes, that was not too bad of a personal income tax growth during that period.
There was not indexation at that time either.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think that's one of the keys here, and especially to get at your 7% is the underlying inflation rate. Mm-hmm. And that I think is where the risk lies. I could easily see your 7% if you've got stable prices.
Yeah.
If we get no change in overall price indices, 7% is not that bad. If you get, you know, their forecasts are really based on this underlying 2 to 3, 3.5% inflation rate. If that's the case, we got 3% inflation, 6% personal income is probably pretty reasonable. If you get 0%, then you're looking at 3% mm-hmm. income growth and the possibility of very low growth in income taxes. And that's kind of the Japanese scenario where mm-hmm. you actually run into deflation.
Right.
And that's, I think, that's the biggest fundamental risk we face.
So that gets me back into this discussion, and I don't want to waste too much time talking about the impacts of the war with Iraq, but it raises, I think, sort of the vulnerability of this concept, because on the one hand, you have potentially spiking energy prices, which would tend to cause, I would assume, an inflationary effect on a number of items throughout the economy because of increased energy prices. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, while that assists on the inflationary side of the issue, the flip side of that is it's gonna potentially substantially narrow profit on so many of the other. So it sort of has this dual effect, and I guess I still then sort of wonder what the impact of that would be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, the forecast service that we subscribe to, Global Insights,
right.
Does have a war with Iraq scenario that they are built into their forecast. And the scenario that they believe is most likely outcome, but they put, I think, a 60% probability of occurrence that's in their baseline forecast that we is a war with Iraq. They weren't sure if it was going to be the end of this month or in February. Now it looks like if it does, it's March. But they believe it's very short. They go in. It's only a couple of weeks long. And it will be over. Now, if our comparison is when we had the Desert Storm situation, when Kuwait was invaded, energy prices did spike, but it was for a very short period of time.
Right, and then they came right
and they came down, especially even though the conflict wasn't over yet there in Kuwait. It was looking like it was going to wind down quite quickly, and markets have to look prospectively into the future, and they immediately drop those prices. So their look is that would be the situation where you would have a spike occur, but not last for very long at all. And then possibly oil prices, which have now creeped up because of uncertainty into the low $30, you know, for a barrel of oil on the Western Texas measurement. That's going to go down possibly to mid to low 20s quite quickly if it looks like the war would be over very quickly. Now, the risk is, if what if this isn't over very quickly? What if it does take a long time? It's a very, very tough situation. Then you do get the scenario that you're taking a look at. The oil prices would stay higher. You have those higher energy prices. That hurts the cost of businesses. You possibly get the stagflation type situation. Inflation a little higher, but the economy not going anywhere. So that is a scenario that we hope doesn't happen, and that's not in our forecast. But we have to recognize it as a risk.
And here in Oregon, we don't even have any significant kind of defense contracting, right, where some states might actually see an increase in economic activity.
Right. There's no upside. Well,
energy production, yeah.
Yeah, or the energy production, that's right. So right, we sort of lose on both fronts.
Right. Still, with some of the defense contractors, there's spillover effects, but you're right, very, very few firms have direct contracts in the defense area.
Okay. Anything else? Is that you're done?
Yes.
Oh, for more information. Okay. Paul, first of all, thank you very much. Are they going to stay around for the rest? Okay, very good. Yeah, okay.
I'll sit down there. And
okay. Again, for new committee members, Paul was our state economist. What years were you in Tom's office, Paul?
Mr. Chair, I arrived in 1989 and was there until the very beginning of 1990. Okay. 10 years. Those years when we were above forecast.
Yeah, I was going to say, Paul was always wrong in his forecast, too, but it went the other direction and no one minded.
But I do remember very distinctly the forecast that was done for my first legislative session, which was the 91 session. We had a new governor, Governor Roberts, coming in, and we had Measure 5 passed, and we also had 500,000 U.S. troops on their way to the Middle East. And we were talking about the exact same issue Tom did, about, and we assumed in the November governor's budget there would be a long war in the Middle East, and oil prices would be stuck at $30 to $35 a barrel. By the time we came into the legislatively approved forecast for May, we had added about $250 million to the forecast because the oil prices had come back down. The economy looked in a lot better shape. So things do change rapidly.
Mr. Chair, I just want to point out, Representative Hobson asked me to point out that by the time Paul was doing forecasts, I had actually graduated from high school. So I just want to point out.
Good to know that. Is it that's out of focus? We've got copies at our desk. Is that just
for the Mr. Chair, you do have copies at your desk. This is an outline of review of the forecast process, and a more detail is in a memo addressed to the House Revenue Committee, and the last page of that memo is a memo from the chair to me in October, really directing me to look at the forecast process and really look at four things: an explanation for the forecast error, and I've kind of taken that as looking at 01-03, looking at the December forecast versus the May 01 forecast. Recommendations for methodological improvements for forecast process, and I have those in the memo to go through with you. And I haven't don't have any specific language, but I have been consulting the Legislative Council, and if it's the committee's direction, we'll go ahead and pursue having some bills drafted that would put in place some of these changes. In terms of the forecast there, and on my memo, I have a table showing, and this is really going through some of the stuff that Michael had on the history, but you can see the history of the forecast is the forecasters, including myself and predecessors, were generally conservative. I mean, this is the first forecast, and again, there are legislative changes in here, so it's not all just the change in the raw forecast, but this is the first forecast we've had below close of session estimate since 81-83. So it's kind of interesting when you look at that. There is that bias. And there's an article. I was trying to find it, and I haven't been able to find it again. It was written in the early 90s. It was in National Tax Journal. But it was did a survey of all forecasting by states, and there is this conservative bias. Now, granted, other states don't have the kicker refund mechanism, which may change the dynamics a little bit, but forecasters tend to be conservative. In general, I think that may be due to the nature of the political process, but you do tend to see that across states, and that does show up here. The key is, though, when we do get these kind of major changes, then they show up in a big way, as they did in the early 80s. What I tried to do was go through and look at the December forecast versus May. And I simplified a little bit by looking at calendar years 2001-2002. So just not to get into some of the timing issues on collections patterns, but to give you a sense of the liability in those 2 years. And if you just take that December number that's in the current forecast for wage and salary income, which is about 60% of income, and look at that number, the wage and salary income is for the 2 years is $10.6 billion less in the December forecast than it was in May. So Oregon's personal income overall is about $100 billion a year. So there's $10.6 billion less for the 2 years, or about $5.5 billion less per year. If you go through and calculate that out and assume an effective tax rate, a marginal tax rate of 7%, that means that the revenue reduction associated with that is about $742 million. If you compare the actual forecast in December with the May forecast and adjust for legislative actions that you've taken, primarily the phase-in of Measure 88, the forecast is down $2.1 billion. So that's about 37% of the difference is in the wage and salary income component. So I think that becomes a particular focus as we look ahead and trying to understand what happened. And frankly, I didn't think I'd come up with that big of a number looking at that. I thought I'd have more unexplained reduction in revenue than I actually came up with. So we can trace back to the components of the economic model, and we can see where the changes occurred. The next biggest component is on corporate income, and that's down $464 million, and that accounts for 23% of the error. And I think you can find it in three sources. One is, as we talked about, the national corporate profits. We have national companies that are the biggest corporate taxpayers in Oregon. Their profits are apportioned based on their national profits. Remember, it's not Intel's profits in Oregon. It's Intel's national profits apportioned back to Oregon. So that becomes the initial base. So the forecast becomes, what is national corporate profits? And if you compare this, and this is something that's taken directly from the National Forecast Service, if you look at the 2001-2002 years, the reduction there between May of 2001 and December of 2002 is $412 billion. Okay, that's about a 23% reduction in the forecast for profits. And of course, that's part and parcel with a decline in the stock market. Corporate profits have not been as strong as expected. Well, if you translate that out, I took 1.1% as Oregon's share, and we talked about that, and that does vary depending on the fortunes of particular Oregon companies, but I used that as an estimate, 1.1%, and applied a 6% effective corporate rate, which is about what it is after credits. And then I've got $272 million reduction in corporate revenue directly attributable to the change in the national profit forecast. So 272 of the 464. The rest, I think, can be explained by the bonus depreciation enacted by Congress in the spring of 2002, retroactive to September 11th, 2001. It's a little over $100 million of that reduction was attributed. That's our estimate for bonus depreciation. And then the remainder, which would be about $75 million, the remainder of that, I think, is probably due to the apportionment factor. Mike had mentioned the personal income in Oregon versus personal income in the U.S. If you look at those two variables, personal income for Oregon, the estimate in December is actually 4.8% less than it was in May. For the U.S., it's about 0.7% less. So that's the relative hit on Oregon versus the U.S. in the forecast, the recession hitting us harder. So if you think through the apportionment formula, particularly the sales factor, That's probably the other piece, that $75 million on the carpet side.
Paul, just on that bonus depreciation, you said $100 million, you think, is the estimate on that now? I know when we started, when that first came in during the special sessions, we initially estimated, what, about $140, $150?
Mr.
And then
Chair,
all that dropped during the course of the session.
Yes.
And it seems to have settled in at $100. Is that still?
Our latest estimate was about, it was a little over $100 million.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the reason for that drop is because of that national profit drop in the forecast, and of course the corresponding drop in our estimate of corporate liability in Oregon. So, and that's obviously, if you don't have any income, you don't have any profits, then we're not going to lose much revenue from the bonus depreciation or any other kind of tax measure because it's not taxable. The real question for us that the forecasters have to wrestle with is what kind of carry forward are we going to see in terms of losses on corporate income? And that becomes a risk as we look ahead in the next couple of years, how much is there. So I think we can explain most of the corporate reduction, certainly the very dramatic. And I think as we look ahead and you think about your 13% versus the 7% and what kind of snapback there may be, profits do tend to come back in recovery periods, but we oftentimes see an extended period of flat corporate profits and corporate income taxes. In fact, in Oregon, our 79-80 fiscal year collections, we didn't match or exceed that level again until 91-92. So we had 12 years before we finally got back above 79-80. So it can be an extended period. So with those two components, we can explain about 60% of the decrease in the forecast. Of course, the other piece here is capital gains. We did begin forecasting capital gains, and I remember first pulling them out and starting to look at them separately about 1995. And so we do have a separate capital gains forecast. Again, this is not something that's in that personal income measure that we get from the Department of Commerce. This is a part of adjusted gross income and not part of personal income. The reduction that, you know, in the May of 2001, I think there was a pretty clear recognition by the forecasters and that the market had probably peaked and was going to drift down. That was the assumption, drift down. But if you look at where we are now in December of 2002 versus May of 2001, for the 2001-2002 tax years, the difference in capital gains income is $4 billion. Forecast then versus now. Translating that into income tax collection, that's $340 million. So that's another $340 million of your $2.1 billion, or 17%. So that puts you up to about 77%. Another component that is volatile and recessions and very difficult to walk through from the economic data to the tax data to adjusted gross income is this business income and investment income. We have some very imperfect measures there that look at that. But what I did was take two components of the economic model. There are components of income, personal income. One is dividends, interest, and rent. And the other is non-farm proprietor's income. And if you look at the forecast on those two, the combined amount of those two, and looked at, you assume a 7% tax rate, it's about $203 million less now than was assumed in May of 2001. So that's another 10% of the $2 billion. So if you look at those four factors, we can go trace right back to the economic model. Those four factors would explain 87%.
Well, going back to Elizabeth's overview on the corporate income tax a couple days ago, and then we talked about those other business entities, the partnerships, the limited liability companies, would those be the ones that come under this number then, when you're referring to business income from non-farm proprietors? Would that include that range of pass-through business entities that would be reflected, whose income would be reflected here? Or are they still part of the wage and salary income on the personal income tax?
Mr. Chair, I think that transition is very imperfect. between those two measures.
Hard to break those out.
Yes, and then the non-farm proprietor's income is one, and Tom talked about the revisions. That's one you see dramatic revisions in. There has been efforts to try to link that data back to tax data, but there's also a number of other sources that are used. So it's a proxy at best, and it's not a perfect match. Certainly not on the subchapter S corporations. They're not.
Representative Bridger?
Paul, when you're looking at this information, obviously you're not going back and going further back from that. In other words, the basis upon which these numbers are thrown out to you, because some of that is confidence in investments, it's a success in business, profitable picture of business, those kinds of things that are the baseline for all of this. So part of that is, for instance, in my own area, a result of overregulation of industries that have completely closed down, that have impacted the economy of Oregon, and certainly the corporate tax and the personal income tax. But when you're forecasting that none of that changes. Is that right? You're taking it as Oregon is today for your forecast, and not any legislative changes or changes in diversity of business and so forth. I'm just trying to kind of get my arms around this.
Representative Verger, what you're trying to do in forecasting is, yes, you are trying to capture those things. I mean, those are very difficult things to do. You capture them, and those are really long-term kinds of factors that would be reflecting Oregon's competitiveness. To the extent that Oregon is a less competitive location than other areas, then you've got a national forecast to work with. And then if you're assuming that Oregon's competitive position is declining, then your income is declining in the share of the nation. If the nation grows faster, you may grow faster too, but not as fast as the nation. So you're always looking at Oregon compared to the U.S. and making that, and those kinds of factors, regulation, taxes, return on capital, education level, all of those things come in as long-term trend factors that determine Oregon's long-term growth capacity. And then you look at those things, you start off by assuming, well, this national forecast is about right, and then how is Oregon going to do compared to that?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Scott.
I think I understand what you said, but as its national forecast in the last 6 months has trended downward, we then don't adjust ours until first quarter estimate or whatever it's called, the one in February. In addition to that, the factors of the unemployment come into play in Oregon, well, at least now in Oregon. It seems to me that those all will negatively impact to a rather substantial degree if you're using the model to base Oregon's. And so if that occurs, optimistically, it seems to me that the long-range forecast has to be much different than what you presented today. If you use that short window to evaluate that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. I there's always two elements to the forecast, and one of the things about having a biennial budgeting system, sometimes those at one point of those two interact. As you're looking at the short-term forecast, the dominant factor is the cycle. What stage are you in the business cycle? Are you in a recession? Are you recovering? Are you about to go into recession? Are you near a cyclical boom? Those are the things that come into play. And I think we would all agree that Oregon's industry mix makes us more cyclical. Okay, if we go into recession, we're going to go down further. But there's a separate question, and that is, the long-term growth. Over time, the economy grows. I mean, it's been growing since the country began. So we know that long-term, there will be growth. Then that long-term question becomes, well, is Oregon going to grow more than the U.S. or less than the U.S. over time? What kinds of advantages does Oregon have? And the biggest advantage we have is our location. We're in a high-growth region. Tom gets forecasts for all the states. So he's got a forecast for California, for the West, and the consistent forecast is the West is a stronger growth region. So here we are, Oregon selling products into a high growth region. We have a good strategic location, including Asia. Then, you know, that's a net plus for us long term, regardless of what happens in the short term.
Yeah, I would agree that that's probably a strong factor to it. But if you're forecasting and you come into first quarter and you're, I would have to think that we are trending on a down, on at least not as high a level as was projected 6 months ago, and so that would. Mm-hmm. Would, you know, that if we do make the peaks and valleys more drastic as far as Oregon is concerned, that would be an indication to us that we may not be moving as quickly as we would have hoped to do 6 months ago or 3 months ago when that forecast was generated.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, the forecast system that we do use from this Global Insights, they are constantly updating what they're seeing out in the economy and what their view is. I mean, if certain risks happen, they will change their forecast. So as we do our quarterly forecast, we are constantly using whatever is the latest that they have put out. For example, the latest that we can use and reasonably get the models done and do all the other work is their forecast for January. In the sense of now where they're in January, this is what their latest look at, given the latest conditions out in the economy. Now, for Oregon, as Paul was saying, we also want to see, you know, relative to what we think the nation's doing, we have historically seen Oregon does follow the nation. Because we have a lot of manufacturing here, we sell throughout the world, especially, you know, throughout the U.S., we do get sort of pulled along. Although, generally in downturns, because of our mix of our manufacturing sector is more concentrated, we tend, especially in this one, when it's a manufacturing-based recession, we felt this a lot harder. In the previous periods, when business investment was growing very strongly in the economy, we outpaced the U.S. economy. And so we had a much larger boom than what the rest of the economy had. So in terms of, you know, what we see, if you know, the idea is like the gross domestic product just came out today, and it was at 0.7% growth, a fairly weak growth compared with estimates, which were about 0.9%. We will, you know, take that information into account as we're looking forward.
Well, let me suggest too, just also that we're going to carry on here, because I think we'll come to some of those things under C when we get to your item C there on the outline, Paul. Things to perhaps make the forecast a little tighter and better anticipate some of these changes. What you're showing us, I guess, here is just where the elements are, where we differ from how we got to where we are, what components of the economy contributed to the current shortfall. But let's go ahead and talk about the strengths and then recommend the technical changes, because I think that kind of gets to what Representative Scott is talking about. What can we do to make the forecast better?
Okay. I have a little bit of history in the bottom of page 3 on the memo about the office was created in 1980. Actually, prior to that, we had a part-time revenue forecaster. There became a real push, really coming from legislative revenue office and from the executive side to try to professionalize the forecasting process. And that's when the first state economist was hired, a full-time position, and his first task was to build a state econometric model. And he hired DRI to come in. Now, you know, has merged and is still basically the forecast service that Tom uses. And they helped build the Oregon econometric model. It's been updated, revamped, and so forth ever since. But the structure remains basically the same. It's driven by the national model, and then it becomes Oregon's industry mix that makes the biggest difference, and then assessment of Oregon's individual industries. System is outlined by Michael. It's basically the same, that the economic model drives the liability, and then you try to make the estimates from those economic conditions, the tax liability, and then the collections process. But I think there are four things that stand out to me, and I've got here is strengths of the current system. nearly all the states, I always hesitate to say all, but every state I know of, and they're in close contact, and Tom's in close contact with other forecasters, use a national forecast model. We all know that the national economy is a key factor. If you're Alaska or Hawaii, you're going to use it yet less. Alaska basically uses the oil price as their key variable. Oregon's fluctuations can be explained largely well over half and over 80% of the last numbers I saw on by looking at national fluctuations, sometimes more or less, but Oregon's very rarely going to go into recession, actually decline, without the U.S. declining or being near recession, slowing dramatically. So that link, I think, needs to be maintained, and I think it's an important one. The second factor is the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, created in 1981 as an executive order by Governor Attia. This group, I think, really remains a real strength for it. They have one of the charges is to review that national forecast and to make recommendations. And, you know, going back to the issue that I spoke to earlier about in 1990, you know, we had different scenarios about a long war, short war, and it's the Governor's Council that really can provide good input on that and give you some good feedback on it. It consists of different industry experts and overall bank economists who can give you a good feedback, and I think that's a very valuable institution to maintain, and we see a number of states have gone that route, and I think it's important to maintain. The third factor that I think is particularly important, and you do hear suggested changes in the heat of legislative sessions and shortfalls and so forth, but certainly in my experience, maintaining a single forecast point, I think, is important. A number of other states, Idaho, for example, California, has two forecasts, one done at the executive branch side, one done at the legislative branch side. And in Idaho, they build the governor's budget on the executive forecast, and then they build the legislative budget on the legislative forecast, which, in my mind anyway, creates confusion and makes the whole credibility of the forecasting process, I think, less. So I would recommend to you that we maintain the structure we have with a single forecast point and that responsibility remaining in the Office of Economic Analysis. The fourth factor would be issuing forecasts regularly. A lot of states will do a forecast, annually for their fiscal year, maybe update, but there's no formal guidelines there. We have very strict guidelines, very strict dates. You know when the forecast is going to come out. The bond rating agencies know when the forecast is going to come out. And they typically will cite this as a strength of Oregon, as our forecasting process, because that information is there on a regular basis, and it does give you some relatively quick turnover if things are changing. So those are the strengths. The technical changes are things that really, there's a number of them that are in the works, and I've got them listed here as underway. And we have been working, and Elizabeth's been working with Michael and the Department of Revenue on a sample. We update our sample every 3 or 4 years, and we've gotten behind on that because of other activities, particularly the special sessions. But we decided we better do that as quickly as we can, and we've updated it to the 2000 tax year. The only problem with that is the 2000 tax year is, of course, not a normal year, so we have to do some adjustments, especially in terms of the capital gains and investment income. But again, it's that one of the things we've done with that sample is restructure it so we really emphasize that high-income groups. Some other things, you've seen some of the industry-specific data Elizabeth showed you on withholding by sector. We didn't have that a year ago, so that's an improvement. Those kinds of quick turnaround, monthly turnaround information can be very valuable. We also have firm-specific information. You increased Tom's authority in terms of looking at individual returns last session. This can be particularly helpful, and we can't talk publicly about what we see, but especially on the corporate income tax side, I mean, we know you know, relatively few companies have basically, their profitability has dropped dramatically. Consequently, their payments have dropped dramatically. And that's a big explanation for what's going on the corporate side and why it's so volatile. It can also give you some early indications of what's happening. The leading index, that's something that's been kicked around ever since I've been here, and it's something that's overdue and can help, again, with citing turning points by giving you a monthly read on what's going on. The other factors, the personal income and adjusted gross income, I've talked about that, thought about this over the years as well, where we have the personal income components, we need to have a formal walkthrough from those components to the adjusted gross income. And Michael had pointed out two of the things, capital gains, pension income, those are not even in the personal income data. So if we're just looking at personal income, we're going to be missing a lot of what's going on. So we need to formally link those two together to get at the ultimate tax base. Another suggested technical change is to deal with the wage rates. We have a pretty broad, crude wage projections, manufacturing, service-producing sector, and government sector. Those can be disaggregated and maybe help explain some of this wage and salary change we saw. We've talked about the bonus income. We know certain industries tend to pay bonuses. This may give us a little bit better indication when wages are starting to drop off, perhaps not in the traditional way that they have in the past. So that may be one of the reasons why we're seeing more volatility now. I think it is. The other thing that the office has done is produce a methodology review. It's kind of been erratic on releases of that, and probably a regular schedule on that would help. Tom has just produced one on the revenue methodology. But going to an annual basis, I think would just have something out there that everybody knows is up to date. So those would be my recommended technical changes, and again, we've been working closely with Office of Economic Analysis on those. On the structural and reporting changes, these are things that...
you could move that up so we can get all those on the screen there. Thank you. Mm-hmm. For the audience.
These are the recommended structural and reporting changes. There's several of them that... The first one would require statutory action. The second one may. But I think one of the things that about our single forecast point system is that both the legislature has a joint legislative executive usage of that forecast. Yet on the front end of that, in terms of appointing authority, is executive branch only. So I think one of the things that might create an atmosphere of greater buy-in, greater acceptance on the legislative side would be to have some input on the appointing authority side. Now, the most straightforward way to do that, I think, would be to create a legislative executive board that could have the appointing authority. talking with counsel, that cannot be done directly, but it could be done indirectly, and I've got a suggested format for doing that. In which the Senate President, the Speaker, the Treasurer, and the Governor would appoint a board that would have the appointing authority for the state economist position, and would recommend the state economist to the Governor, who would have the actual final appointing authority.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart was looking befuddled about why that can't happen, and it's a separation of powers issue, mm-hmm. Representative. Yeah. That prevents.
In fact, Representative Barnhart, who had raised that issue to me, so he was. We had talked about that, and that indeed was the case in talking with counsel.
Right. I was listening carefully to see how he was going to get around that problem.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Good. All right.
Of course, you know, nothing to decide today, but we've talked about this. You've named four members to that board, and four is always a problematic number, just because it can devolve to two and two. One thing this committee might want to consider if we are moving forward with this, and I'll ask Paul to go ahead and get some legislation drafted for us to look at, would be, you know, if we were to go to a five-person board so that you avoid that risk of a deadlock, who that fifth person would be and where they would come from. Again, nothing to decide today, but that's something we ought to be thinking about.
Again, on the advice of counsel, the governor would still have the authority to reject the recommendation, but then the board can make another recommendation. So the board would ultimately have a major impact on who was on that. And given the fact that the governor would have a member on the board as well, I think it would probably be pretty straightforward on a recommendation. The other function, I think, of the board, and I think one of the areas that I know has caused a good deal of concern during the interim and the forecast cycle we've gone through with declining revenue has been a release of the information and a release of the forecast itself. There's a sense that there's not joint ownership of that executive has that before the legislative leadership does. So one of the recommendations I would make is that the board would assure that their appointing authorities would receive the forecast information simultaneously. So all four executive and legislative leadership would have the forecast in hand at the same time. There wouldn't be one that would have it and the others wouldn't. So that would be a recommendation, I think, that would improve credibility. I think it would clarify some of the lines of authority for Tom in the office as to where that forecast goes initially.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
It seems, given the model and the way the model works with so much communication with folks from DAS and the departments at several stages of that thing, it's going to be, to some degree, I recognize that you can have the envelope that you slide the final product into that gets released equally, but it seems that with that level of involvement, and I don't remember from the model, is legislative revenue involved in those same meetings that DAS is involved in at that point?
Yes, legislative revenue is involved in the economic review.
Okay.
I do have another step.
Oh, okay.
In this recommendation here that I have, but what happens is, frequently get the question of, well, how's it looking? Now it's down 100, down 200,
right,
down 300.
Right,
you know, you get
right.
That kind of thing. And I think that really does add some confusion. But also in terms of there's a release, so there's always a lag between when the numbers are finalized and they're actually released. And so that's what I'm trying to cover here, so that when those numbers are finalized, they go to the appropriate appointing authorities, and they're all informed at the same time, and therefore are going to be in an equal position in terms of reacting to it.
I think that's important. I mean, I know I've you know, for as long as I've been in this building, the conversations in the stairwell, you know, beginning 3 and 4 days before the release of the report, even back when you were the economist, that, you know, here's what the report's going to say.
Mm-hmm.
And that raises the question then, well, how do you know what the report's going to say? Where's that information coming from? And you know, there's never been, as far as I know, and I will say this on the record, any issue as to the independence of the actual numbers in the forecast or the information going into it or the credibility of the, you know, of Tom or you when you were doing it, none of that at all. But I think it does have an effect on the appearance of it when somebody has the numbers ahead of somebody else, when everybody needs to be relying on those numbers together. And I think this factor here of controlling the timing is critical. Like the Department of Agriculture, the federal level, releasing the orange, the report, the commodities report on the orange fork harvest, or something like that. I mean, it's credibility is enhanced, I think, when everybody gets the same information at the same time.
Yes, I agree, Mr. Chair, and I can say very confidently, I was state economist under three governors, and there is absolutely no pressure to change the numbers, as you say, but the release point does become a source of contention. The other kind of institutional change that I would recommend is, you notice when Tom walked through his process, he's got an economic forecast, meeting with the governor's council, they kind of outline the assumptions underlying the forecast, go back, do a preliminary forecast, and it's reviewed. Okay, that's reviewed, and there's some changes made, and that becomes fed into the liability models to produce the revenue forecast, but there is an overview of the revenue numbers, revenue forecast numbers. The suggestion here is to create a revenue forecast advisory committee that would review preliminary revenue numbers, predominantly personal and corporate income taxes, and make recommendations or reactions to that the ultimate decision, I think, in any type of a forecast process has to rest with one individual, and that has to be the state economist. But I think that it would help in terms of, particularly when we get in these kinds of periods we've been in, where, you know, you can kind of see what's going on economically, but the revenue fluctuations seem to be much greater, certainly than anything we've experienced.
So this would be a committee corollary to the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors.
It would
be the revenue side of the forecast process.
Yes, Mr. Chair. But I would recommend that it be exempt from open meetings law, because I think, given the sensitivity of the revenue numbers, sure. Now you do have press coming to the Governor's Council meetings, but they can't really. I mean, they kind of get a general sense, which is fine. They should have that, but they can't really link it back to revenue numbers. And I think a group like this that's actually looking at revenue numbers and saying, "Gee, I think that's too high or too low," and giving some real straight and honest responses would need to be exempt from public meetings law, so they could give the kind of advice Tom would need on that. And that, again, would meet quarterly to review preliminary forecast numbers. Another issue, I think, gets at Representative Williams and your concerns, Mr. Chair, about kind of speculation on the forecast and what's happening, is it tracking up or down? The Revenue Department produces an awful lot of information. It's all public. They produce a daily banking report that shows the amount of withholding receipts that have been received at the department and so forth. All of that's pretty tough to decipher. But they do also produce a monthly receipt report, which doesn't have all the general fund sources, but it has personal, corporate, cigarette, all the things that the Revenue Department collects. And that monthly report is the final numbers. And those are the numbers that the forecast has to match to. I think one of the things that would help you as policymakers and might quell some of the kind of speculation that goes on would be a monthly revenue tracking report that would go to you, that you would receive, and not provide a new forecast, as Tom pointed out. I mean, he spends, 8 to 10 weeks developing the forecast. And I think other numbers thrown out there would confuse things. But Idaho, for example, does produce a monthly update, and they just show the sales tax numbers and whether this month is tracking to what they thought and some of the reasons why it might not, or some of the, caveats and interpretations of the data. But I think that probably would help decision makers to have the expert opinion on these trends and what's going on and what does it mean in terms of what we're working with for the current forecast. So that would be a recommendation that would not require any statutory change, just a change in the part of the office procedures. And finally, the Office of Economic Analysis, when I first came in 1989, really had one duty, and that was to do the general fund revenue forecast and the economic forecast. It was needed to do that. Since then, the office has done a number of things that, at least in my view, I think are very consistent with their mission. Lottery forecast became a big responsibility. Prison inmate forecast. But there's some other things, too, like cost responsibility study is now done under the auspices of Office of Economic Analysis. And so what I was just recommending here would be a legislative fiscal office budgetary review of those functions. And if they're taking away from the primary function, then maybe some of those ancillary functions should be sent off to other agencies to do. And that's something that I think that the fiscal office could provide a good review of.
Okay. These are, Paul and I have talked about this, and my information would be to ask Paul to work with Tom Schopp and the Legislative Council to get some, especially under item D, some of these things drafted in legislative form for us to look at, again, with every intent of being helpful and making things better for everybody. Any feedback from the committee? Obviously, we don't have anything in front of us to debate or discuss in the way of a bill, but in terms of concepts, is anyone uncomfortable with this direction? Representative Berger?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'm a little concerned. I'm new and didn't go through recent months. Forecasting took a lot of hits as recent economic changes happened. I'm a little concerned that what we're looking at here is an overreaction to some rapid changes in numbers and folks taking a lot of heat for it, and just building bureaucracy, if you will, around this prematurely. I wasn't here. I know there was a lot of heat. I was reading the paper about why isn't the forecast, you know. So that is my concern.
Well, yeah, and I guess my thinking on that overreaction would be if we were to create a legislative office of economic forecaster within the legislative branch. I think that would be clearly an overreaction. This seems to me to be more incrementalism. I mean, just fine-tuning of the process. We'll know, I guess, when we get the bill back. But I don't see this as being revolutionary. Tom, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I mean...
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, a lot of these items down here in both C and D were actually things we had thought about before we reached May 15th of 2001. For example, we've been trying, we've talked before about it would be great to have a the Revenue Forecast Advisory Committee, sort of a technical to help us. We already informally been talking to tax practitioners and how do people do estimated payment, you know, and what's going on out there. So we'd like to get maybe some people from some of the high tech firms that are the financial CFOs people there. You know, maybe they can help us to get a sense of what's going on, and they can be a little more open about our process. We've changed our. One of the problems we have in our forecast process is we want to use the most recent information, but we also need time to do the forecast. And in the past, we've always had this lag period that Paul's talking about where we finalize the numbers, and it takes about a week before the green, this publication that comes out quarterly, can be released. And it's over 100-some pages.
Yeah.
What we've decided is that we want more time to work on the forecast. So we now are sending that to the printer maybe a day before we release. It'll come out still in a week, but we can put that immediately on our web page the moment we do our presentation, like to your committee. That also provides us more time if we have a review committee, which we had barely 2 weeks from when the economic model was formalized to get all the revenue numbers done. Well, we can add now another week onto that process. And so there's room now for this technical report. So I'm viewing it and working with Paul that I think in part you're right. A lot of this was pushed a little farther because of the situation that occurred. But it's not really out of line as to things we'd have been thinking about. And we just needed the time to do it. We had been, when I first started a leading economic indicator model. And then I found out what Paul knew all along, that you hardly have any time once another quarterly forecast comes to do it again. But now we've got an intern from Willamette University. We're helping getting some other people involved in the process. And this time we're really going to do it. So I feel comfortable with it, actually.
And Rosenberg, if I can add, I think that's a very good point. But I guess kind of bottom line, I would think of this as, I would see this as having no fiscal impact. If you think about, of course, the advisory committee would be probably folks within government and practitioners on a voluntary basis. And the only thing possibly would be the forecast board. But I would see that, I guess I would envision this, and I don't want to get out ahead on this, but, you know, the speaker or the Senate president would appoint somebody who's probably a practicing economist that could be a member of the governor's council now that would provide that kind of input on that position. And so they would be people that would be doing this on a voluntary basis.
Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Hobson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to say this even before Paul's wonderful defense on the fiscal impacts, and I wanted to marvel at the political astuteness of our hardworking staff, because there was no request for additional funds. However, in the last one, we are looking at perhaps moving some functions someplace else, which I think that really does need to be investigated, because it sounds like you keep dumping more things into an agency, and it does weaken their ability to do what their core mission is.
All right. Well, then, I appreciate the overview on this today. We're just about out of time, but I will ask Paul to go ahead and continue to work with Tom.
Yep.
And Legislative Council and get back a draft to us. Thank Michael and Tom for your time with us today. It's always a pleasure to have you in the committee. And with, I know it's not always a pleasure for you, but it's a pleasure. So with that, we will be adjourned. Paul, tomorrow we are meeting. We have floor again at 8:30. Is that right?
Quick floor, and then the meeting after. We have a panel on economic development policy. And revenue policy of really the business perspective. So I think you'll get some good insight.
This will be good stuff. We have some panels coming in as part of our orientation. We'll get into more bills next week.
Yes, bills on Monday.
Tomorrow will be a discussion on impact of tax policy on economic growth and development. We've got labor perspective coming in later. We've got local government. We've got local government coming in. So just trying to gather all the perspectives on how tax policy affects different sectors of our economy, both public and private. So tomorrow will be the business perspective. With that, we are adjourned. We until 4:05 tomorrow morning.